And everyone was telling me that about Marvel as well. Like, oh, they had a baby and they're going to work on a Marvel show. Twins, are you sure? So everyone complains about the no CGI stuff, but I'm the one, no, give me CGI. Give me Pacific Rim robots kicking ass.
This is Fernando Herrera, veteran visual effects animator, supervisor, instructor, and personal friend of ours. He has worked at MPC, Frame Store, and is now at ILM Vancouver. His work on His Dark Materials Season 1 helped win the show an Annie Award in 2020. We are super excited to sit and chat with him about his experience so far.
There's the supervisor that makes the shot worse. There are those types of supervisors. We can't lie to ourselves. Anyone could push S and navigate Maya. You could teach anyone that in the day. It's just the decisions that you make. Just be aware, if you don't really love this, you're going to be competing with a lot of people that do. So if you're just doing this for a job, it is maybe not the best idea.
Most conversations that are happening about visual effects don't include active artists.
Reply to that. Say something. We kind of got tired of being kicked around. Right? So everyone looks at that shot and say, oh, that looks awesome. How did you do it? But that shot was miserable. I was really shy guy growing up. People would even make fun of me that I didn't speak a lot or whatever. My friends, I was the quiet guy. I still am, I think. Especially in a foreign language as well. So mm-hmm. It's not easy to adapt to that. In the first few weeks of MPC, my brain was hurting. Mm-hmm. Like, the first month, I think, because it was a lot of things to learn, and like just switching to another language the whole day, it was hard.
Did you already speak English before you arrived?
Yeah, I did, and I think I learned English like watching Friends too many times.
Yes, we have a friend liker. Evan hates on Friends all the time. I love
just
Friends.
Just don't know. So I watched it, like rewatched it a bunch of times, and it's good. And I think, and I even when I was an animation mentor, I met one of the guys when I was in a graduation, and they were asking, where are you from? Do you have this kind of New Jersey accent? Or, where am I from, Brazil, dude? Maybe I got it from Friends.
So you had a kid recently.
Yeah, she was born in September 13th.
Congratulations. So
almost like 2 months and something now.
Your third.
My third. And the twins are only 17 months. So everyone says, oh, it's like triplets. Yeah, it's like triplets. It's not easy.
That is incredible. The timing of that is incredibly funny too.
It was a bit unexpected, I won't lie. But it's all right.
Congratulations. Yeah. How does it feel balancing work with the kids and everything?
I mean, working from home, it helped a lot. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know how I would do it if work from home wasn't a thing nowadays. Mm-hmm. Because it's not like I have to spend the whole day with kids on
right.
on each arm. But just by like helping move a baby here and there or put him to bed like 15 minutes... Mm-hmm. I don't know how parents did that before there wasn't work from home. Like, we can't imagine, basically. I think it makes me more focused as well somehow, even with a lot of kids in the house.
Yeah.
Because I think if you're in an office alone, you don't have a lot of people to talk to as well that naturally you're going to.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you just try to be more objective, I guess.
Less distractions.
It's less distractions.
How do you manage, like, I know I always have trouble, like, disconnecting.
Yeah.
Actually, I find myself doing more hours than I normally would do even when I was in the studio. How do you manage that?
So, I think in my case, I really don't have much of a choice. Because I have to stop at some point and, like, go take care of the kids. Mm-hmm. You just have to train yourself to be very objective, have a task list. If you leave it to chaos, it's gonna take you the whole day. But just organizing yourself a little bit, setting times, like this time is I'm gonna do whatever. So even animating now, I try to set my day like so I know days at this time, so I'm gonna spend this hours animating. And when you know you have like that block of 3 hours to do something, you're just gonna switch off anything else. Just listen to some music, I guess. But when you have, I feel like if you have too much time for something, it's easy for you to deviate and do something else. But if you have smaller chunks of time, I think it's easier to focus. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You're a lot more self-aware of your schedule just because you're kind of responsible for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, I was always very keen on telling everyone not to ghost hours because that hurts the whole team in the end. So I was always trying to really be like, if you don't have enough hours to do something, you just have to tell production because that's the realistic time it takes you to do something, right? It's not easy as animators because you're not just doing a job. You guys probably know. You always feel like that shot is your baby and you want to make it beautiful and do everything in the bells and whistles. Mm-hmm. So it's not easy to detach and say, okay, let me stop here. Let me show the soup and see how that goes.
How would you handle, like, I know you've been a supervisor before and a lead and now you're back to animator, but when you were a supervisor and we were all working from home, how did you handle, did you notice the people that were ghosting hours? You know, you always kind of have a hunch.
It's harder to notice. Yeah.
Right.
It's a bit hard. I mean, sometimes you see it, like by the time the people submitted something.
Right.
Well, I was always trying to convey that because as a supervisor, I think that's also your job. You have to put a good culture into that show, at least. The company is something, but people have to be aware that it's okay. They didn't have enough time to do something. Just ask for more time. Because we kind of feel like sometimes that if you didn't have time to finish something, you feel like you're owing something to the company. Oh my God, I couldn't do it. But it's not really like that. I think from my experience, they prefer to know if it takes more time so they can budget properly, you know? When you're new to the industry, you're more keen to do that because you want to show what you can do and you want to show that you're fast and whatever. So I understand, like sometimes it happens and you just have to be careful not to go too far as well. Because it's a bit frustrating because we know that some projects have really low bids. So how do you balance that?
Right, exactly. Like how do you, if they set you up with like a very limited time, how do you balance?
Yeah, so I always try to do something like, being from Brazil, the industry there is mostly advertising and it's always really fast paced. So I kind of got used to doing stuff, how to do something look good in little time, at least the bare bones of what makes the shot look good. So, I noticed that even if I don't have enough time, I should spend most time that I can planning and blocking. So if those two things are in a good shape, I will have enough time to polish. And I think it's, for animators, it's a bit hard to detach from the little details that no one's going to notice. So what I always try to tell my students and the people I was supervising is you have to prioritize the things that will make the most difference in the shot. So if you're able to do that, you're going to be a lot better as an animator because we only have limited time. Like let's say you have 10 days to animate something. Those 10 days is the quality that your shot is going to have. There's no more or less. But depending on how you put your time, you can, even if you're the same person, the decisions you're going to make is going to make a difference in the end, the results. So usually I try not to skip planning and not to skip blocking, whatever is a blocking, so it's step blocking or spline or layered, it needs to show what the shot's gonna do early. Mm-hmm. And if you're able to layer your notes, even for yourself, or if you're giving notes to someone, I feel like you have to think about first what the audience needs to see, then the director, then the animator that is frame by frame. in the film.
Well, yeah, and this is probably an important thing to bring up also while you're leading or supervising, the thought of like simplifying your feedback and really just focusing on the main like intention or of the shot and the shot in context too. That's really important. Exactly. A lot of people will go in circles trying to meet a supervisor's expectations when it really like you have to see the thing in the bigger picture.
Both of those things are skills that we have to develop, right? So I notice, I always tell my friends and my HODs when I was working as a sup that I think there are three types of supervisors. That's a bit controversial, but there's, and I always was worried that I wasn't doing a bad job. So I think there's the supervisor that makes the shot worse. There are those types of supervisors. We can lie to ourselves. There's the supervisor that is neutral. So he's not probably going to improve the shot, but he's managing everything, so it works. And there are the supervisors that actually improve everything. And to me, when I started to do that job, I was really worried that I was at least neutral. So because it's really easy for you to get in the way of the animators, right?
Yeah. Being a little bit more self-aware when you, you know, when you do give a bad note, which is inevitable. Sometimes you have ideas that don't necessarily pan out in the shot, and just being able to own that.
Exactly.
To protect your animator, because that's also something that.
Yeah, I really, I always liked when supervisor would say that. So let's say I give a note, so move the arm up. And I notice on the next step, it looks bad. So I would say, oh my God, sorry. Didn't work. It's on me. So. And there's no reason why you can't do that. And I think it makes the animators trust you more in the end. Because you're just being honest. You're just one of them. In the end, you're just helping organize everything.
Exactly. Yeah, that's super important. Building that relationship is really important too. So I think transparency is the key there.
Yeah, I think it's with everything, right? So you don't really need to overthink. It's just be a regular person, which is not very easy.
Honestly, no. There's a lot of like, you know, pressure from production side, from even your own personal pressure and insecurities. It's not easy.
Yeah, exactly.
You have a lot of experience teaching.
Yeah. So I think I'm up to more than 10 years now. So I have a little school since I was working in Brazil. It's just for the Brazilian students so far. It's a bit easier to teach in Portuguese as well. But I always wanted to keep it going because even if we are just little by little, like getting all the people through the course. So like 10 years, I think we formed, I don't know, more than almost 100 animators already. And in Brazil, that is a small industry.
Yeah.
You feel like every time you go to the studio, your students are there. Yeah. I don't know if you guys remember at MPC at some point, there were
Whole clan.
There was a clan of Brazilians in there. And well, a bunch of them were our students or heard of us or whatever. Yeah. It was me and my friend, Ivan. I think it's at DreamWorks now.
What was your motivation behind starting it when you first did?
I don't even remember very much, but I remember I was really fresh out of Animation Mentor. And we noticed that a lot of people wanted to learn, but you can't imagine it's very expensive in US dollars for if you live in Brazil. So it's very laid back, and a lot of my students became my friends later because it's just a very personal relationship. We never wanted to get really big. I think that was a mistake for us. So we always kept it just the two of us. And that's been what we're doing for 10 years.
It's interesting that you haven't opened it up to the rest of the world if it's online.
The problem is we always have like a waiting list and whatever. So we never felt like, okay, we need more students. So we might as well just keep teaching in Brazil. We might do it at some point, but I don't see it.
You mentioned briefly like how the industry in Brazil for animation is more commercial.
Yeah.
Is that mostly what you were doing before you came over?
Yeah. So I spent most of my career doing commercials. And basically, I think there were not a lot of animators when I was working there because there's not enough companies. For example, the biggest company there Vettor Zero had like 6 animators. That was the most that a company would have.
Right.
So you can imagine if there are like 10 companies, there will be like 15, 60 animators working in Sao Paulo. Nowadays, it's more because they start to do TV shows. And I don't know if it's because of streaming or... So when I got to... When I moved to Canada to MPC, I was really self-aware, like, because I moved already as a lead animator. So, oh my God, they're going to find out that I don't know what I'm doing. Because I never really did this in big movies. It's high end. It's...
Yeah.
So you notice, so I noticed, okay, I can do this. Who would have thought? So,
you had a bit of an imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Well, we always have that, a little bit of that, right? But mm-hmm. moving to another country and working in English, that wasn't a big thing for me as well. So in the end, you notice that the skills that you develop, even in projects that were not like super big or high end, that kind of trained me to be very efficient as well and well-rounded.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, I had to be a generalist in the beginning of my career as well. So it really helped me do the job as a lead and a soup leader.
It's really interesting that you bring that up because I was always, so I went to school in the School of Visual Arts in New York.
Yeah.
And they also, they were not just an animation school. They taught us a well-rounded sort of, you know, we learned modeling, rigging, lighting, all that stuff. Very surface level, obviously, because, and then they also make us do a student film at the end of it. I was always thinking like, if I spent most of the time animating, I could have probably had a stronger reel.
Yeah.
And it is true because I was competing with other students that graduated who did spend all of their time animating, which did have stronger reels. But at the same time, nowadays, I'm really thankful for that like well-rounded sort of experience that I got because I am able to communicate better with other departments. And even though my knowledge is only surface level, it's still enough to help me communicate and really...
Hey. I don't know if you noticed, but even sometimes, like in VFX, sometimes you have to do some sort of presentation in your shot. Okay, let me just do this plane here with a shader or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's very basic, just knowing a little bit more of the software makes you more comfortable to work in it. So in our school, we actually ask the people that apply to know a little bit first, to have studied some shape or form. Like, it's not from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't really need to present an amazing animation review or anything. They just need to show us that they've been through something before. Because I think usually the best path to me, if I was thinking of, like, if I have to tell my nephews or my kids how to get into animation, I would probably tell them to do a course like that that shows you. So you have to understand what the industry is, what the 3D software is first, and then a little bit later, like maybe 2 years later, to start really learning about animation only. Because even though animation, it's a bit detached from the software, it's your tool. So if you don't feel comfortable there, it's always going to be that thing blocking you from doing what you want.
Yeah, and you also learn, like, we're not the last, you know, step in the pipeline. Yeah. And you also learn, like, why you have to make certain decisions in the shot to make it everyone else's life easier as well.
Anyone could push S and navigate Maya. You could teach anyone that in a day. So what is, it's a bit cool to think, so if anyone can do that, what changes physically someone from animating?
Right.
So it's just the decisions that you make. So it's very mental, and that's why it's so heavy mentally.
And it takes some prep, like, too. I can't just sit down and start. It, like, mentally, you need to be somewhere.
You have to be in the right mindset. Yeah. I think that's why this job is so hard. Because you can be a good animator one day, and the next one, something is happening in your life, and you just don't have it.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a bad shot, and you're going to feel like you don't know what you're doing. Because maybe not for the company, but for yourself, you're always going to be as good as your last shot, right? So sometimes you feel like, okay, I can do this. Sometimes you're going to feel like, oh, what am I doing? What am I doing?
And that's also why morale is so important too. I mean, it's not just about numbers and products that we're putting out there. Yeah. Like the environment that we work in is really important.
Yeah, I always heard that argument. Sometimes I have a few friends always talking about, oh, what we do is art, and no, it's not because it's commercial. Or
we've had that talk before too.
There is a lot of that talk, but in the end, well, it's all of your creativeness going into that. So it's not just pressing a button, even if you're realizing someone else's version or a view of something. So I do really think it's some sort of art. I don't have to label it.
You consider yourself an artist?
I think it's semantics as well. Like, it doesn't really matter what it is. I think it's just, it's a creative job and your mood affects it.
Right.
So it's, and there's also something talking up again about supervising. I feel like if you spend too long without animating, if you try to go back to it, it's a bit hard because
I was actually going to bring that up. Yeah.
It's not like it's okay, my workflow, I don't remember. You remember your workflow,
yeah,
but you're not in the right mindset. So that is enough for you to derailing everything. So I have a big belief, at least, I don't know if anyone is like myself, I think you should never stop animating if you're supervising. I'm not saying you have to animate the same amount, but I always try to keep at least two or three shots going.
Of course.
First, because I really love to do that. And second, I think it's just important for you, not only not to lose it, but I think it makes you better as well. Because
of course,
how are you going to give the best notes possible if you never animated that character? And sometimes just saying something like, why don't you turn the head that way? Because it's going to... because I tried it and it didn't work, you know? So I think it makes you more efficient in the end. I understand it. There's not a lot of time.
But it's really important. Even if it's a simple shot that you do, you don't have to pick the most complex shot ever, but just being familiar with the rigs that you're, what you're giving feedback to or at least
even if it's like in the pre-production part of it, if you're just doing the dev shots, so you learn the character, because that really, really helped me always when I was doing it. I don't tend to just stop animating because I'm really scared of losing it. I don't know.
How has your relationship with animation changed over the years? You know, you've been animating now for over a decade. And that's not super common. There's not a lot of people out there that's been around for so long. Yeah. I feel like animation is a pretty new thing.
That's interesting, right? We don't really see... like granddads.
We don't have a lot of granddads.
No. I think that's a good question, because I remember being always very passionate about it. And that's something that I like to tell my students as well. Like in the first day of class, like, okay, you're going to hear a lot of, okay, you have to work really hard and like work weekends or whatever, because otherwise you're not going to make it. Or, I mean, it's partly true, because if you say working hard, it kind of has a connotation of, oh, you're going to be stressing yourself, learning a formula or whatever. Yeah. But I don't know, to me, it was always a hobby as well. Like if I wasn't working, I wanted to do a personal shot for myself. So it didn't really feel like work. So what I tell my students is just be aware. If you don't really love this, you're going to be kind of competing with a lot of people that do. So if you're just doing this for a job, it is maybe not the best idea, because as we said before, it's very mental. Your mentality when tackling a shot makes all the difference. So if you don't have the passion behind it, it's going to be really hard to be one of the best, or to be the best that you can as well.
Yeah.
So I think if you're not starting and you're not really passionate about it, I think it's a bit a tricky career to choose. I always had that passion from the beginning, and I don't really pride myself in working hard, because I didn't really feel like I was working hard.
Right, yeah.
I was just doing what I loved. And that in the end, that the result of that was good for my career. So with the years passing, I noticed that it changed a bit, because, for example, I was one of those guys that, okay, the new Disney movie, I need to watch it the first day. Nowadays, I'm kind of, I don't really want to. Because, I don't know, it's not even, oh, it's not a good movie. I don't really care. I like superhero movies, or I like the stupidest movies you can see if it's fun. But it's just, if you see too much of the same thing,
Yeah, it's the same.
It's always the same design. They're
using similar formulas.
For I just get tired of it. So nowadays, what I'm not really passionate like that. Like I don't really follow. Like sometimes there is a project that comes by that I want to see that. So Arcane, for example, because it's different. And I think part of that, the passion to watch stuff, I think it went away. But it kind of got replaced when I got into VFX. I really liked watching creature stuff and VFX heavy. So everyone complains about the no CGI stuff, but I'm the one, no, give me CGI. Give me Pacific Rim, robots kicking ass. I always feel like it's the coolest thing ever and people are going to love to see it. And every detail you put on it is like, oh, see that? And I don't know, especially when you're passionate about a project. Guardians 3 was a little bit like that. I didn't know if people were going to love it, but we really felt like that was really cool.
It was awesome.
And yeah.
Yes.
And really everyone loved to animate in it as well. So everyone was passionate. And in the end, I think your relationship with animation in the end, I think the most important part is if you love animating, like doing the animation, it's not really just watching the result later, because we can't, no, it's not going to lie as well, because it's good to have the validation after, right? So you do something and it becomes a success or whatever. So, but what's the most important thing really is if that was cool to work on. There are some shows that I have a few examples actually. Like one of the coolest shows I worked on was Lumberland. And if you ask anyone in the streets, no one's probably gonna know that. Some people, I watched it and I cried and whatever.
Yeah.
And the pig was so cute. But it was not a very high profile movie, but everyone loved to work on it. So I think that's and I think that's some animators sometimes they have this fear of missing out. So they figure out in the coolest blockbuster, you feel like you're missing out, but sometimes that is not going to be the coolest show to work on for your mental sanity.
Yes, well. Yes.
Sometimes it's going to be more fun. You're going to be doing your more creative work on that other show. So, yeah, I think you shouldn't really choose your work just by what's
going to end up. Higher profile movies tend to have more cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's true as well. So. Yeah. And everyone was telling me that about Marvel as well. Like, everyone that worked on Marvel shows, it was scaring me. And, you have had a baby and are going to work on a Marvel show? Twins, are you sure? But in the end, I don't know. Every show has its own characteristics. So Guardians 3 was amazing. And I don't know if it was part of the director, the client, the team at Frame Store. So everything was a perfect storm to work. And it was not easy, but it was super fun.
Most conversations that are happening about visual effects nowadays don't include active artists. Do you think this affects the narrative of what's being said?
Oh, yeah. It's frustrating because it's like we don't exist at first, right? And I became the old get off my lawn guy on LinkedIn because I just got so tired of it. You just keep reading. It's not just regular people on the street that, they don't know. But sometimes it's people that work in the industry. So important people, directors, actors, writers, or whatever. And they're saying things that they don't even know what they're talking about. Or worse, if they know, it's even worse because it started to show up as a no CGI movement, like that was a bad thing. But people don't even know when they see CGI if it's good, right? So
yeah, especially the people who are promoting the tools that we work with in post production. I feel like it's really interesting for me to see some of their comments or opinions on how something is affecting our industry, where when they don't necessarily have shot work experience, like you're not necessarily there working on the shots, putting out these sequences.
It's weird, and I don't think it's even the right decision to market your movie like that, because no one really cares about what a computer did. you want to care of what a human artist did. That's impressive. So if they were trying to frame it more like, okay, you see this group of amazing artists, they did this by hand in a computer. Can you believe it? That was, I think to me, that would be more impressive. And I don't really, I don't buy the, okay, it's just the bad company guys that are trying to hide your work for profit.
Why would you think that, what would be the profit behind it? Why would be the
it's just,
reasoning?
Oh, they're trying to hide you so they don't pay you more. I mean, I don't think they think that far. It's just this is how it's been done for years, and no one knows better, I think. So if I think it just takes someone doing it right and it being a success. I think it's less of the evil corporation and more of, okay, this is being done. Everyone does that. That movie that was a success did it, so let's just do it. And that's pretty much how Hollywood works, right? So if something worked, they try to replicate it in some other show. So.
I have some questions in front of me that are from our Agora community. Cool. So some of them are mixed with mine and some of them are mixed with the community. So let's go through them. I think they're going to be fun. Do you feel pride in your work? I feel like you already answered this a little bit.
Yeah. Not always. Like I said, like I think my biggest shot in my career was the two bears fighting on his arc materials. And everyone looks at that shot and say, oh, that looks awesome. How did you do it? Like, and I feel like, I think everyone needs to know that, by the way. So when you watch something in the screen and you think it's awesome, you always think, nah, the guy is good. It was easy. You don't really think it's easy, but it feels easy because you see the result and it makes sense.
Yeah.
But that shot was miserable. Like I was going home like maybe for 3 months while it was in progress. And like every Friday that it looked bad, you would think about it the whole weekend. So you can imagine, it took me a while to feel pride on it because I knew the process was so hard and very heavy. So in the end, I almost couldn't see that if it was looking good or not. And it was not even, oh, I got too many notes. It was just hard to do. It's not those type of frustrating shots that, oh, I had to change it for the 50th time. It actually was pretty streamlined, and the client was on our side, and it was just creatively super hard to deal with, and the workflow and the physics, the body mechanics of it, it was just so hard to do. And I feel like I got out of that better than I was before. I think every time you struggle with something, you just know that after you're going to be
better off.
The other end of it, you're going to be better, you know? If you're doing something on your comfort zone, it's usually, okay, just doing it.
Minimal growth if you're in your comfort zone, What has teaching taught you?
Oh, that's also a cool one because I keep repeating it. Teaching is very good because it makes you rationalize what you do. So animation is very instinctive, I think, because usually you watch what you're doing and you react to it, what you have to change. And a lot of people, they animate, they don't even, if you ask what their workflow, maybe some people will have a hard time explaining because you're just doing what you feels right. At least it was more like that for me in the beginning. So if I had to teach someone to do it, I had to put that on paper.
Right.
And I had to really explain step by step what I was doing and why. And a lot of things you do, you don't even know what you're doing. You just know it looks better, right? When you stop to rationalize why that looked good or why that works, then it all starts to click. And it makes you repeat more than before. Because if you're doing something by instinct, it's hard for you to replicate. Then if you had to explain to someone, now that is recorded in your brain a different way.
Yeah.
It's kind of like planning, right? So planning is similar in that sense because I think I used to say that we think that we imagine things more concrete than they are. So if I tell you to, okay, imagine a tiger. So yeah, I can imagine a tiger. If you try to draw it, you don't know. Where are the details that I just saw in my head? They're not there.
Yeah.
So that's why planning is important, because it makes everything which you're doing more concrete. And now you can relate more visually or by writing sometimes to what you're doing. So teaching really helped me with that, because I think I became a lot better animator just because of it. Not that I learned new stuff, but just by changing how your brain reacts to it, mm-hmm. I think it makes a big difference. And I actually wrote about that at some point. And I think everyone should try to start to give notes to some, to your friend. It's hard because some people are more shy than others. But if you push yourself to just talk to your friends, talk to your friends about your shot, suggest something, try to explain why, you know, that helps a lot in your own work after. Mm-hmm. Just be selfish. Just do it for you.
Not for anybody else, yeah. Just for you. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. I think that a similar thing happens when you start supervising. Yeah. You start having to explain the reasons why you're making certain decisions. And
yeah, I think both of are pretty similar. I think supervising mm-hmm. job is very similar to teaching. It's not, I mean, you don't really have time to teach someone to animate while mm-hmm. supervising. It's something, maybe it's a misconception as well. I notice mm-hmm. some people think they're going to, oh, my dream is to work at Disney because I'm going to learn. You're going to learn a lot, but no one's going to, you take your hand and explain how to do something. You have to come with that. But I think that part, I think maybe making it concrete is what it makes the whole difference, I think, in the end.
Yeah. What is it like having a spouse that is not in the industry?
Ooh. I think it's a bit similar to what we were saying about people that don't know what we do. So trying to explain to someone early on, like when we got together, it's super hard to explain what you do without giving weird examples, right? Mm-hmm. I don't remember what I said to Deborah, but I remember a friend of mine who was a lawyer. And after like many years of being friends with him, What do you do for a living? Anime? What is that? Tell me, what is that? So I was trying to explain. So, okay. So, you know, Lion King. So instead of drawing, we have the little doll in the computer and we animate it. So Lion King was drawn frame by frame. So, I mean, it's hard for us to understand that people don't really even know how traditional animation was. Mm-hmm. Never stopped to think about it. Even when I was starting with 3ds Max in the beginning, I knew how to model shapes and whatever, but I would watch Shrek and I had no idea how that was done. I knew that was this, okay, there are joints, maybe there are joints inside of the body. And I even tried to animate once. I remember doing this little ball with legs and I put joints inside and I tried to animate in FK because this is super hard. How this guy is stabilize the feet. So I never knew a rig existed.
Right.
It's funny, right? So try to explain to someone that doesn't know what you do. I ended up realizing that really being specific doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So they just have to understand how is your day to day and what takes for you to focus and why do you have to stay for a few hours focused. And
yeah, just the amount of dedication and time that it takes, I feel like it's difficult to communicate to somebody who doesn't understand. Yeah,
especially like working from home, if you don't do that with your spouse or your partner at some point, you're just gonna get frustrated because someone's gonna say, oh, can you just stop for 5 minutes and do that? And you can't. If I do it now, I'm gonna lose my 2 hours of train of thought. At least it's what I with me. So I need to have the chunks of time for it to work. But yeah, it was, I think everyone kind of goes through that a little bit. But there are pros and cons. The pros is that you don't talk about animation all day as well. Especially in the beginning, when you're really passionate, I think you would be very tempted of talking about work all the time, right?
Yeah. What makes a good client and artist relationship?
Client and artist. Yeah, that was something I had to learn as well, because I think the artist, I think at least in VFX, you don't really have a direct relationship with the client, right? Usually as a supervisor, you do. So I noticed people, at least at MPC at first, people were really scared of the clients. I don't know if you guys noticed that. I think it was just maybe the show that I was on. But then at Framestore, I realized it was a lot more as a partnership after. And you have to try to build trust early on. And I think it's just like every regular human relationship. You don't, if you try to earn trust, it's all gonna work in the end. So I always feel like in the beginning, it's a bit more clunky. When it gets to the end of the show, you're trusting each other.
What are some ways that you'd recommend somebody that's trying to build trust with their client?
I think it's like we were saying before, just being a regular person. Don't try to be impressive or just be honest. Like people I usually notice they were scared to suggest notes sometimes. So I noticed when I show something that I know is missing, whatever, I would say, hey, this is this shot. I was planning on do this, this, and that on the next step. What do you think? Usually they'll start to trust you and you know what to do then. Mm-hmm. And just be honest and don't be too serious or just try to treat them as a regular person. It usually goes long ways, I think.
Put your ego to the side.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, it's a hard relationship because you're usually in a lower status, right? Mm-hmm. Because the client is a client. So yeah, sometimes you'll be tempted to be too like respectful.
Too much of a yes man.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that hurts his own show in the end. So making them trust you in the end is good for them as well.
Given how like common it is for multiple people to touch one shot in VFX, how do you deal with like feeling ownership of your work?
Right. So I have two answers to that. Mm-hmm. So first, I would go to hell and back before I would reassign a shot.
Okay.
So even if you have to explain to the Pope that that's gonna make the show worse, even if I had to be indisposed with someone, mm-hmm. or even if I had to create a situation, like that is one of the most important things to me, is to try and not make that happen. Mm-hmm. As most as we can. And I would tell that early, the production team, and explain why. Mm-hmm. And I noticed, like, because that culture kind of lives in VFX. So people are used to do that. But when I got into this show, I would try to impart that culture. And in the end, they would agree. Okay, that really worked. If I didn't reassign this shot, it gets approved faster. Mm-hmm. What do you know? So that's what all everyone wants, right? So mm-hmm. everyone wants to finish the show in a good shape and whatever. So, but that said, sometimes it happens, even in the best families. It would happen. So feeling ownership of that, it's hard because you know you didn't start it. Mm-hmm. So what I started realizing is, part of trying to feel ownership of something is the fear of missing out that we were talking mm-hmm. a few moments ago. That, oh man, you always want to have that shot, and I did it, or I can't put it on my demo reel. But I think if you put your mindset into being the most positive you can on that show, that makes a huge difference in your career later. Mm-hmm. It's hard to have the patience because, especially when you're starting your career, you just need a lot of stuff for your demo reel. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're not going to feel like you have ownership, but you have to be proud of doing that work. And maybe you can't show it after, but who worked on that show, people who worked in that show, or your soup or the prod people will know, okay, this guy did a good job because mm-hmm. he was efficient, he didn't know, so the client understood what they're going for. So in the end, I always try to be very professional with whatever I'm doing, even if it's not, sometimes it's not even something that feels like it's animation, right?
Right.
Okay, this rock needs to fall here and do whatever, so okay.
Yeah.
But you have to feel joy in whatever you were doing. Not sometimes it's not even just animating, sometimes it's okay, I'm being helpful on this show, and maybe I don't feel like I have ownership after, but I have to feel ownership of the process, and okay, I helped my supervisor or help the lead, or and I think in the end that is the most important thing in the industry anyway. Demo is a bit overrated in the end.
I feel like they lie to you a lot.
They
demo
do.
Reels.
Yeah,
I feel like we're like hanging on too much onto demo reels.
Because it's so hard to judge as well. Like
yeah.
Even after 20 years of experience, you look at something, oh, you think it's really cool, but it's if you take all like the render and the simulations from it, it's hard to really see what's really there, even for experienced people. I had a lot of talks with Kyle, our HOD at Framestore, and he's a master of looking at the demo reel and realizing what level the person, but it takes so much practice and so much experience, and even them you can be wrong. So networking and people knowing if you're good, it goes a long way more. I think it's more important than demo reel. It's how I got to Framestore. I worked a year at MPC, and all my shows were rescheduled and reshoot and whatever. And I didn't have anything. I don't have a demo reel. So the way I got to Framestore was someone that worked with me said, hey, this guy's good. You should hire him. And I think if you know that early on in your career, I think it's going to help you not care so much about demo reel.
Yeah, you mentioned mocap, and I would love to ask you a little bit more specific about mocap, just because I've noticed a lot of people talk about it online, and again, with the same like situation where they don't have a lot of experience in shot work using mocap, and they don't really understand. And the marketing of the films and the TV shows doesn't help either, because they usually market mocap as, you know, a one and done, or like very minimal, you know, changes, and that's it. And, you know, oh, this project used mocap that, you know, the animators were just, you know, for show. But I don't think that's the case almost ever from my experience. I feel like the mocap usually evolves quite a bit before it gets to the big screen. And can you talk a little bit about that and how?
So I'm trying to remember now which shows. I don't think I had to work a lot with mocap. The times that I did, I feel exactly that, because you have to change it a lot. But in the end, I think you're right. Even the best mocap, I would be curious to talk more with people that worked in studios like they're heavier with that, like Weta. And you hear stories like oh, I had to do a lot of stuff on this, on King Kong or whatever. Or no, on this one, I almost didn't have to do anything. But even knowing that you don't have to do anything, it's a big thing. Because as I was saying, you're supervising before. You can be good, neutral, or bad. You can do the same as an animator. Maybe you can make the mocap worse. So, yeah.
Also, it's very rare that like they're shooting mocap with the final cameras or any of the final ideas in mind. It's definitely useful to have a first pass like iteration in front of us, but it's not necessarily something that ends up in the movie at all.
That's true. And there's something that I'm really passionate about as well. Is like VFX, we have to do realistic animation, right? But being realistic doesn't mean you have to do what a regular person would do in a day-to-day. So for example, if I have to lift a box, I'm not going to look at a tutorial of how to lift my box so my back doesn't hurt. I'm just going to do whatever I do every day. Or if that is not going to feel, for example, if I need to animate a sword fight, I'm not going to look at a real sword fight because that doesn't look appealing. I'm going to look at choreography of a sword fight. So I have to make the realistic motions, but not the realistic, how do you say?
You have to use the Hollywood timing
for
the sword fight.
You have to choreograph everything to the camera. Yeah. So an animation even is even more, because an actor, they don't really have to think that much of how my eyebrow is looking. they react and it's more natural. Mm-hmm. So you have to replicate what live action does 10 seconds in 3 weeks. So there's, and the reason animation is so appealing to people is because we think of every little detail and we make that those things feel appealing. So it's like taking the best case scenario of whatever scene you're doing mm-hmm. and putting that in the end result. Mm-hmm. So even if you're animating a realistic thing, you just have to find whatever is more appealing, even if it's not real.
I feel like the word realistic is deceiving. I feel it like is. We should use something more like believable. So you're doing something that's believable.
That's true.
But yeah. You're...
suspension of disbelief.
Basically. Yes. Yeah.
If it feels realistic, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. I've been in many conversations like, okay, we're animating a talking dog. Oh, but... the dog doesn't do that. Okay, it doesn't talk as well. So you just have to make that feel like if a dog would talk, this is how it would look like. It's kind of like that.
By the way, that's like my biggest pet peeve, talking dogs.
Really?
Can we just stop doing talking dogs? Dogs are gorgeous and they can communicate without talking.
It's
Why
hard.
Would we?
it's hard. I think at some point I was saying doing the perfect realistic talking animal is kind of like the holy grail that everyone was trying to find the right thing.
Right.
Because I don't think anyone really nailed it.
No, and dogs are like, we look at dogs so often in our daily lives that it's really hard to trick our brains to
exactly.
believe that. When you do like animals like bears or stuff, like it's a little easier
exactly.
because you don't see them as often.
Yeah, it's animating dogs, I think, is the closest thing to animating a human face. People mm-hmm. are going to notice any detail is out of place because mm-hmm. you're just so used to see that. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because when you're animating something, again, you have to think about what the audience thinks mm-hmm. Of that. For example, how do you animate a dragon? Oh, maybe I go look into lizard reference, but I have to tap into the mass people.
Yeah, the history of dragons
exactly.
being animated.
There is an expectation of what yeah. a dragon does in mm-hmm. in the collective life.
Yeah.
Right? So if you don't do that, there's not a dragon. What the hell are you doing? So I think part of it is you have to understand that some things you have to be really close to people expecting, like if you're animating a dog, even if it's not talking, mm-hmm. What people think a dog look like, and the same thing if it's a fantastical creature,
mm-hmm.
how do you find the best appeal for something that doesn't exist, right? Super hard.
Yeah, super hard. The last one is a bit hard to answer, but I'll bring it up anyway, because we love questions that are hard to answer. So it's a bit of a loaded question. So the first part of it is, why do you think audiences hate VFX? And not thinking about it from the inside VFX standpoint, but more from the outside.
Yeah, I think it's just, you just read something and you repeat it. So there are a lot of trolls that... like, for example, if I see someone hating on VFX online, oh, the CGI of this is it sucks. First, they just learned that from someone.
Mm-hmm.
They saw someone doing it and find it was cool. But in the end, they don't really know what they're talking about. So part of it is because it's just became a cliche saying that, but good VFX is usually invisible. So mm-hmm. if you're doing your job correctly... some people are not even going to see, and they're going to see whatever it looks out of place, right?
Isn't that like super tricky then? Because like whatever, if good VFX is invisible, then, you know, the marketing teams can say whatever they want about the shots that you're looking at and they
yeah.
can.
Yeah. And it's different. For example, if you watch Pacific Rim, that's like giant robots kicking Kaiju's ass. In the end, it's hard to say, oh, it's invisible. It's not invisible VFX.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the key word is like people believing it, like you're saying.
Yeah,
so if it looks believable, it's the correct thing. And I think in the end, it's a fight that we're never going to win, because it just became a thing. Like, I watch movie reviews
mm-hmm.
and say, yeah, did you, for example, I read one from the Marvels yesterday. I didn't watch it yet. But the guy was saying, yeah, the movie's good. CGI is pretty good as well. Like, why did reviewing the CGI became a thing in movie reviews? The guy doesn't even know what he's saying. Like, CGI looks good. Yeah. Basically, what he's saying, yeah, he didn't bump me, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I think that's our job, really. We have to do something that, even if it's spectacular, just doesn't bump anyone. And sometimes it's not our choice. Or most of the time, it's not our choice. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, if you're watching like a movie and the sky is red for some reason, someone is going to wonder why the sky is red. Mm-hmm. And maybe they don't like it and they say the CGI is bad because the sky is red and not blue, you know? Yeah. So it's just, in the end, I think it's art direction. So if the art direction is good, no one's going to mind it. No one said Avatar 2 CGI was bad, didn't they? Or Dune, or whatever movie that with a lot of VFX, you know? So I think it's just, for some reason, that culture is out there for people complaining and putting CGI next to everything. But I think half of them don't even, like 99% of them don't even know what it is. So I think I'm choosing to stop being frustrated with that, because it's a losing battle. Like,
yeah, what do you think?
Die on that hill.
Yeah, what do you think would be the, like, the best possible response from our community towards that kind of issue?
I think when it's like whatever person online hating on it, whatever. But what I really feel like is when someone from the industry is doing it, or doing it on purpose. Like, you see, I saw a couple of weeks ago someone saying that Gran Turismo movie had no CGI. Just a lie. Don't lie. It's just, and I think part of what we should do is just, okay, reply to that. Say something. Because we kind of got tired of being kicked around, right? So
you think speaking up is important?
I think so. You don't need to fight someone or whatever. But when I see something, I flag it, and it happened a couple of times that it becomes a big thing.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not easy to communicate either. I find that, like, for people that are not animators, or that we don't, like, some of the terms that we use in animation, people misunderstand, like, they use them in a different way and it doesn't translate. So you're having an argument, but you're not necessarily talking about the same thing, which I wish I had some more specific examples, but it happens a lot. I noticed people are having back and forth, and I'm like, well, what you're saying doesn't mean what he's trying to say. Like,
it's just the terms. I think you're right. It's just even saying, like we were seeing last week, like DigiDouble. What is DigiDouble? It's not AI, or it's just something someone modeled or scanned or whatever to do whatever a stunt double would do that would kill them. So. Maybe that.
I would like to add to that, just like keeping things respectful is important too. I know that there's a lot of snake skin in the game for everybody, but
that's true. And remaining... I don't think trying to convince anyone really works, because especially online, people just want to be right. Whatever they're writing, they don't care to learn what is correct or not. So just be light about it. And yeah, but it's tricky, because I feel like, I think we've been so, our status is so low that we don't even feel like we can speak up about it.
It's true,
right? So now I'll say, someone is hating on it again. You should be furious.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, empowering artists is definitely something that I hope this podcast will do to some extent, just to give people a voice a little bit.
I hope people at least are aware of these things and look for it. Just reply and say, no, this is not correct. Or, in fact, I worked on it and it wasn't really, like, don't say anything that you can't, that your studio, like it's like secret or something. Mm-hmm. But it's a bit of a fine line, really.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to
us
today.
Thanks. Yeah. I wish you a lot of success on the next ones.